Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad,
a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news,
we're watching,
fashion trends, pep talks where we give advice,
mental health moments,
and games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Hello and welcome to this extended interview with Lee John, the Imagination frontman. Now, as the main man of Imagination, Lee enjoyed hits in 28 countries with Flashback, Body Talk and Just an Illusion. And in this interview, he talks about a documentary that he's been making about Black British music, which is also called Flashback. His life during 80s Britain, his musical influences, the time as a child that he spent in New York, and his first appearance on Top of the Pops. It's a revealing, open, and sometimes moving interview, and if you live through the 80s and 90s, you'll recognise some parallels to your own life. And I started by interviewing Lee about his parents.
There was always music in the house. They came from St. Lucia, and so therefore we would listen to the music of the day, Calypso, Jim Reeves, Nat King Cole, in any Black Caribbean house in the 60s in the UK, that's what they'd be listening to. But my sister was a big influence because she was listening to Blue Beat and Ska and Motown and Stax, definitely Stax. And she was into, she liked the Rolling Stones more than she liked the Beatles because she thought they were more edgy. And I remember when I was very, very young, my mom bought me this record I heard on the radio, and it was You Don't Know by Helen Shapiro. And I should say Helen Spatiro, you know, and I just love that. Well, my love, I love you so, but you don't know how much I feel. Da, 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 da. The melody was in my brain. And it stayed. That was one of the first melodic musical references. But then I do remember that in school, when I was in primary school, another piece of music that got into my brain was Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, which has stayed with me for a long time. And I didn't even realize what the music was until, you know, the last 30 years I discovered it, rediscovered it. And so that was interesting. So at a very early age, it was very diverse. And then singing She Loves You and all that kind of stuff. But when I actually started to get into music, one of the first records I actually bought, by that time I'd moved to the States, my parents had split, moved to the States, and on the corner of where we lived was a record shop, so I'd listened to such diverse soul R&B music. You know, I wasn't even in my teens yet, and I bought My People Hold On album by Eddie Kendricks. And at that time, Lady Sings the Blues, the first version of that with Diana Ross came out. And I'd gone to see the film and was so impressed by the film. I wanted to know who this Billie Holiday was. So I read the book, and then every reference in the book, I started to buy the music of these people like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Satchmo, you know, Josephine Baker. I wanted to know all of these people, who they were. And I just soaked it all up. And then at that time, I started to listen to people like Isaac Hayes, Hot Buttered Soul, you know, this is before the theme from Shaft came out. And then there were the vocal groups that were about. Obviously, everybody was into the Jackson 5 because you were a kid. My cousins were into that, you know, The Love You Save. And I used to love the Maybe Tomorrow album and Never Can Say Goodbye. But then I also liked things like... Is it Laura Lee I listened to, and the Presidents, and one of the local groups, very influential for me in a sense, just before I came back to the UK, was called, a group called Black Ivory, and they had a song called "Don't Turn Around." Don't turn around. Da, 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 da. It was a very falsetto type sound, and they had another track called "You and I Have an Understanding," which was a beautiful, beautiful song. And at that time, it was a time of the Temptations and all these other groups, the Shy Lights, the Stylistics. But I was mainly influenced, I think, by Motown, because I saw something that I could be. I could be a Four Top, I could be a Supreme, I could be a Jackson 5, I could be all of these people all in one person, because the fact is they were doing it and they put it on such a heavier stage. But then I also loved people like Aretha Franklin. You know, I love the gospel side of stuff. And one of my favorite all-time versions of You Only Need to Get By was by Aretha. And I gravitated to, always wanted to know who wrote the songs. So I found out it was Ashlyn Simpson. So then that connects me with Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. And then I became a fan of Ashlyn Simpson at a very early age. I bought all their albums and till the point where, for me, the favorite album they did was Stay Free, Nobody Knows. This is like the late 70s into the 80s. And, you know, I just loved how they combined being in the soul pop into with the element of gospel with it. And then, you know, I loved all the divas and stuff like that. But one of my favorites was Natalie Cole. And I got to meet her in the mid 70s. I was writing for a magazine. Not magazine, it was the Caribbean Times. And a friend of mine and myself, we managed to go to Capitol Records, which was EMI in London. And this lady, Debbie Bennett, who was always involved in press and promotions, she managed to give us a white label of the very first Natalie Cole album, and which has some wonderful songs. So, you know, I was just a fan from then on, you know, and she had so many hits. And I think about Natalie, she was so diverse with her style of music. She did jazz, blues, soul, gospel, pop. And that's what I thought for myself. That's where I want to be. You know, I want to be able to be very diverse in the things that I do. So even when I formed Imagination, that was my main thing I really wanted to do.
Can I take you back just a second, though, before we get to that area? Because the one thing that really fascinated me in a way, because I come from a family of parents that also split, is that you lived with your father, which is pretty unusual. What was the relationship with your parents? And do you think part of my drive in life came from needing my father to love me in some way. You know what I mean? I always felt that my father didn't love me, and I think he didn't really. there's lots of people probably say that. And I think there was a drive, and I just wondered, because whenever I talk to really famous people, they have this drive in their life to achieve something, and particularly early on, and that drive comes from an early age. And I just wondered if you'd ever analysed where your drives may have come from?
Well, my mum and my sister were very strong influences. My mum's always been working in the community, the black community in the UK. And she's, you know, she's an MBE. She worked half her life. And my sister was also involved in arts to a degree. And when she went back to St. Lucia, she was involved in charity. And I grew up in a household where you couldn't be lazy. You know, you can just sit down and say, okay, you know, when I left school, that's it. You know, even though if I wanted to be a singer, I still had to be doing something, do a job. And then, you know, in the nights you could still sing, you could do this and that. So, but prior to that, when my father took me to America, he actually didn't tell my mother. So he literally, they're split by that time. And he kind of took me on this long voyage on the SS France, the longest ship in the world at that time, took me to America. And we were on it for like 2 weeks. In those days, they took long times to get to across the ocean. And my mother had no idea where I was until she got a postcard. So there was always that longing that, you know, I want to see my mom, you know, where is she? You know, and with that, with the memory of what I loved of England and stuff, there was a smell, there was a sense, there was colors. Then when I went to New York, it was like going into Disneyland. It was completely different. As a young black guy coming from the UK, I just saw so much of people of me. I saw my own reflection. I saw in so many different ways. And I thought I could probably do da 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 da. To the point I got signed to a label that my father's wife pushed me to go into, but my father didn't know. And I won the audition, and then I recorded a few demos when I was very, very, very young. And, you know, I remember singing for them, is it Close to You or something like that? And Me and Bobby McGee by Janis Joplin. For some reason, I love that song. And that's how diverse the radio was and stuff. But when you talk about my father, he came from a background where they didn't show that affection to their children when they were growing up. When I was younger, yeah, but as we grew up, he was like, he just expected me to win the swimming meet. You know, I joined track school, you know, expected me to get, you know, he just expected it. You know, but I didn't feel like I was always trying to prove myself. And to the point where there was a moment when Imagination became successful when I came back to America after coming back to the UK. And he turned and he said to me, which was very, very, it cut me in two, was that if I didn't send you back to England, maybe none of this would have happened. Instead of saying, wow, son, you've done really well. Look at you, da, 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 da. And afterwards, and right from that moment on, I thought, I don't need you. I'm bigger and badder and better, and I don't need you. I can get on and do it myself. You know, you've provided me a platform of birth, but I can now move on and do my own thing. And even before he passed away, which he passed away in 2000, he was very much still thinking that what I did was a job, but the real job was come back to St. Lucia, look after the land, look after the property. That's where you should be, you know, should be doing. But when he passed away, in his belongings, I found all my albums.
Oh wow!
And it was like, you know, and he'd been talking to other people about me. That was the situation, but he would never do it to my, I think to my face. But I think he was brought up in that Victorian sort of, you know, this English tradition. Which was passed down to the Caribbean, of not really praising your children. You know, a lot of them, you know, they don't show their affection.
Maybe, because, I mean, I think when you listen to your voice and when you listen to your music, it is very much of perfection. It's very much, you know, like you have this feeling, wow, he's really going for it here completely. And it's funny because I read about Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, who was an absolute perfectionist in arranging and everything, that his father never ever told him that he was any good at anything. And so he spent his whole life looking for that confirmation. And it's sort of a similar confirmation. I wonder if that sort of led you to actually say, right, I'm gonna prove. There was a moment, obviously, where you stopped doing that, where you stopped saying.
Well, yeah, I still do, in a sense, in myself. I still try and be a perfectionist. I still try and be the best of what I do. I still think I'm still learning, you know, and that's what led me to technology and stuff like that. And I thought God, I don't know as much as them. I need to learn a little bit more. I need to learn a little bit more. I don't know those dance steps so well. I can't do that anymore. You know, I'm older now, so I can't do this. So, all right, I need to do that. But I've always felt that I needed to be the best at what I do. And so like with all the Imagination songs, Lee Johnson, I did all my backgrounds, all my harmonies. You know, Ashley would come in on a few bits. But mainly, I remember meeting Freddie Mercury and he was just stunned and astounded at how I did my arrangement. So he was saying, because he had to play all the chords to do the vocals, but I just did it all in my head. You know, I'd be in the studio and I'd go, we'd be talking and I'd do the harmony, they'd do the harmony. And, you know, and I was always very, very quick. Like our first album was done like maybe 2-3 weeks, you know, and writing, and I'd written songs from before, which we put in there. So I always had this aptitude of, and I loved harmonies. And one thing I can always say, I never thought I was good enough. That's one of the things I always, because prior to Imagination, I was gigging, I was doing working men's clubs, the Caribbean clubs, the bingo halls, pubs. It was fantastic, great audiences. It was a great training ground. And now I was also in the studio doing background vocals for this one and then doing a few demos here. And they were never quite right. I'd go to this A&R guy and say, what do you think? I said, Lee, it's okay. You're getting there. I was never quite getting there until I did this demo with Trevor Horn. And he had hired me and another girl called Sonia Jones. I don't know if you know Sonia Jones. Sonia Jones was one of the main big session singers back in the 80s and 90s. She did loads of things, but she's very well known that people don't even realize it's her imitating a Shirley Bassey-esque sound on the soundtrack of Life of Brian. She's the one that says, Brian, babe, they call Brian. And a little Welsh girl. And we were starting together doing our sessions and it was really cool. And we did a track called Cuddle Up and Hold Me Tight for Trevor Horn, for Eurovision. We weren't going to sing it. It was somebody else going to do it. And I did one called Taste the Wine or something. Anyway, he liked the tone of my voice. He kept saying I sounded like a young Johnny Mathis, which I thought, oh my God, no, Johnny Mathis, that's my mum. That's, you know, oh God. I mean, I grew to love Johnny Mathis's sounds as I grew older, but then I thought, oh my God. And the second person who said I sound like Johnny Mathis was Diana Ross. We were doing a tour and somebody said, oh, I was with Diana Ross and she heard your record and she says you sound like Johnny Mathis. I'm like, ah, you know. But it was that situation. At least I was being compared to a legend, so, you know. But the Trevor Horn scenario got me into the studio with him, and he was working with, I think, Jeff Downs from Yes, I think. And before Buggles. And we were in a studio in Camden Town, if I recollect. And we did a couple demos, one called Stand Up and Dance, and one called Dr. John, which is, you know, I Got the Medicine, which was very pseudo disco, but it was like, it wasn't very good. We were experimenting a lot. And then I didn't like what I did because it didn't sound right. So I redid the whole vocal again and called it It's My Life. Changed. That's when I knew you could always change the version of the song and people wouldn't know. And and then he called me back and said, look, I've got this other song. I want you to try it out. Maybe you can add in something to it. So I heard it and it was this big production. And I thought, bloody hell, this is really cool. And at that time, he was going out with Tina Charles. And so she was, I think she's on the song a little bit. It's called Got to Be Good. And it just had all this production. This is like early Trevor Horn. And it was so visual when you hear the song, the bass and everything like that. And then I forgot about it and put it aside. And then he got big, I think that's 79, 80 with the Buggles. Video Kill Radio started to blew up. And so somehow or the other, somebody recommended me to go to R&B Records. It wasn't R&B at the time, it was Redbus Records. And Morgan Kahn, who was doing a bit of everything, DJing and promoting records for PRT distributors in Marble Arch in London. He was crazy. I thought I was wild, but he was crazy. He was like, man, I want to get this. He played me all these records and said, you know, I want a track like this, da 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 da, and played me all these music. And they're all from America. So then I said, you know what? I may have a song for you. So I brought the cassette down, left it with him. He called me back in a few days and said, I want this song. I want this to be the first song on our label. You know, it was supposed to be a Lee John record. There was no imagination. So I said,
that was Body Talk, was it? Was that?
No, this was Got to Be Good.
Oh, okay. Just to go back to a couple of things, because I don't want to jump too far ahead. When you talk about the working man clubs and actually like having to do what people like Elton John did, which is he did it in the 70s, which was learn his craft by endlessly playing clubs. And you did the same. And what's interesting about people like you is that there's a moment where it all comes together. There's a moment like, I don't know if you've ever seen Michael Jackson at the 25th anniversary of Motown, and Michael Jackson does the moonwalk, and he's Michael Jackson finally. Do you know what I mean? Adele at the Brit Awards when she did Someone Like You, and you just feel that moment, and you go, wow, that's everything's come together at this time.
And suddenly
it works. What did you learn from those clubs, do you think, that really added to becoming Lee John of imagination?
I learned about the audience. I was with the Sun Valley Serenaders at the George Canning Pub on a Thursday night. And then in the rest of the week, I was a singing waiter, singing songs from the West End. We're the Waiters of Encore, we sing and dance, we give you more than any other supper top pub in town, with Gary Shale and an actress called Tammy Jacobs and Sally Temple and Steve Armley. I'd love to track these guys down now, I really would. And we had we were on the front pages, I think, of the second page of the Evening Standard, of this place called Encore. So I was doing that, and then dash away I do the George Canning Pub between 7 and 10, rush down to Brixton, dash to Encore, change up, and get ready to do the midnight show.
So what did you learn from the audience then? What was it specifically?
Learning from the audience was that don't be afraid of them, number one. And also, if you are yourself, they will embrace you. And also, how to interpret different songs. Because I was singing everybody else's songs. I was doing reggae, I was doing calypso, I was doing the songs of the day. And until I started writing I was always writing my own material, but... I mean, for example, the bingo halls were the greatest audiences because you did three little spots and I loved it. And, you know, you get the old ladies coming up and giving you, hello, love, would you like a drink? Hello. You know, and, oh, here's a little fiver. And, you know, and if my mates came to see me, they'd drink up all my savings, all my earnings, you know, because they'd say, oh, put it on his tab. But it was like those bingo halls had like sometimes like 2,000 people because they were old theatres. And so it was like, wow. So I learned how to experiment. I learned about how to experiment with my the way I dressed, how I threw my voice. I learned to just the communication and how you knew when you were singing, like I'd sing Daddy's Home, how to melt someone's heart, you know, by singing that song and how to do it and just capture someone will go,
Tell me, how do you melt someone's heart? Tell
me. When you sing that song, when you sing Daddy's Home, it's going to melt someone's song. Oh, my love. It's the melodies. You know, it's the melodies. It's really hard nowadays because some of the songs you hear nowadays are so electronic and sound like computer games with vocals on top of it that they forget that the stronger songs that hit you, even like Body Talk, there's a melody. You know, and you can remember those melodies that stay with you forever, those classic songs. And that was the thing, because I was also doing, I was going to Anna Shear's acting school. I was doing stuff like that and I wanted to be the best at what I did. So I was trying to really, you know, make sure my craft, I knew every area, you know, and I even did, I got panto, but not panto, but like theater thing. I played Brer and Nancy, the Spider-Man. And, and that was with, actually, the musical director was Chris Cameron, who was who became one of the main musical directors for George Michael. At one point, I was in three groups. At one point, I was doing Fizz, which was a jazz funk group, Sun Valley Serenaders, and something, I can't remember who the other ones, but with Fizz, we were doing all these college and university gigs, and they were like young guys, and myself, by this time I had Ashley on board playing bass, and we did the Cassio College and George Michael's band, I can't remember the name, they were supporting us. So I thought, wow, I'm big time now, you know, supporting us. And I remember Andrew Ridgely and I think David Austin, I think, were you know, we were all backstage and stuff like that. And but by this time, I was very seasoned. I thought I was quite seasoned because I'd done Encore, I'd done all these gigs. I was really, I had this professional thing. I knew where the next step was going to go, you know, and I knew what was not me by that time. And I always wanted to prove that I was a live artist. Even now, today, you know, it's just about getting on the stage and just delivering.
I just want to take you back to what you said about America. And I find that really interesting that you said it was the first time that you were somewhere where you had this mirror to you. So there were these black groups out there. And so you could see people doing something that you wanted to do, as opposed, I presume, not completely, but I would have thought that the perspectives for a black person of, you know, of our age back then, it wasn't good. It wasn't easy.
No, I mean, no, because basically, you know, I was lucky. My primary school at Gillespie was multiracial and it was very mixed. So you had Greeks, Turks, Asians, you know, everyone. It was, and people from different Caribbean in Finsbury Park. It's one of the first really big multiracial schools. And I went back to that a couple of years ago and saw my ex-teacher. And she told me how, you know, it was in the papers, how multiracial it was, the community was. But at the same time, there weren't black shop owners, to be honest with you. There weren't black teachers. It was just people of power weren't in with you. I didn't see myself in that reflection. And there were very, very few black artists at the time, unless you saw them doing Calypso or ska, that sort of genre. But the genre I liked in particular with soul always was from America. So when I landed in America, all of a sudden, it was like, wow, the Jackson 5 had broken by the time I got there. And my cousins were saying, you don't know the Jackson 5? I mean, I got there by the time I Want You Back came out. By the time I got there, it was The Love You Save. So they were like into stop, baby, to save me. It was all that, you know. So it was very unusual because you had the Jackson 5, but then you had groups like War, who I loved. That became one of my main groups that I really loved, Eric Burdon's War. And then at the same time I was in America, there was the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And the month before that, I think, was Martin Luther King. So it was a very heavy racial time. And the Black Panthers, I remember on each corner, you had these Shabazz bean pie places, and they had these shops that would have joss sticks and posters. And it was very, you know, I'm black and I'm proud. And it, you felt this kind of, hey, you know, something's really, it was a proud moment to be and see history changing. And then bam, Isaac Hayes wins the Academy Award. Bam, you've got Diane Carroll on TV with Julia. Bam, you've got Flip Wilson with his TV show, comedy show. Melvin Moore and Clifton Webb had a summer special, you know, and everything was notable. Why I know the names is because they were so relevant. Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, everybody in the school talking about the fight of the season, you know, the Temptations dance routines. We all wanted to look like and be the Temptation because they were slick and they were classy, you know. So it was like, and I was still very young. So it was so diverse. And then, you know, you had the jazz musicians like Miles Davis and stuff really freaking out, and Herbie Hancock and stuff. I mean, but then, I mean, I got into a lot of the instrumental music because I was always a clubber by the time I came back here, and got into the whole club scene, the whole, you know, UK black club, soul and reggae, you know, those two sides. I was part of all of that. And, but in America, it was all there. And when I came back, it was like cold soup. You know, I was watching Slade and Sweet and Gene Genie, and I thought, what the hell is this? And was it Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep? That just drove me absolutely bananas. I thought, and I was sitting in school, but the records that I had were really heavy. So, you know, I had, I remember I brought with me the Midnight Movers and Follow the Wind, and it was a really heavy track. And I, of course, my Eddie Kendricks album, which had Girl, You Need a Change of Mind, which is like a classic floor filler. But it was so diverse. It
so
was
you, so, found, so you diverse. Found that music again only in black clubs?
In London. Import, you go to Contempo, which was in Hanway Place, Hanway Street, in just off Oxford Street, or we go to One Stop, which not a lot of people even remember, which was like, I think it was classical, but then all of a sudden they started to have a section where they'd have jazz, funk, and soul, and you can go into a little booth and sit down and listen to the record. And I had remember I always had a cassette tape recorder. Everybody knew me, I'd have a Panasonic cassette tape recorder, and I'd tape some of the tracks that I was listening to. Or I'd go to Cheapo in Rupert Street, and you get the same album there, but cheaper, like instead of £15 for £2. And, you know, but I was an avid record buyer, you know, because I just loved the music. And then while at school, when I came back from the States, I was just wanted to know what was going on. And my cousin took me to like my first blues in called Bluesville, actually. It was in Turnpike Lane. And it was heavy dub, heavy reggae, which was cool. Wall-to-wall dreadlocks. And, you know, we were lying and saying, oh, we're going to the pictures, the cinema. But we weren't. We were going to this club. And I'd go there for a while and I thought, you know what, this is okay, but they'd only play one soul record. I couldn't dance. It was always very, very dark. And so therefore, I don't know who it was. It was somebody said, oh, you've got to come down to this club on a Friday lunchtime. I said, lunchtime? God, we were at school. But normally on a Friday lunchtime, they'd have a half day. So you could go home in the fifth year, I think it was. And we discovered Crackers, where George Powell was playing and Mark Roman, the DJs. And I saw like-minded people there. Also people that then went into groups like Light of the World, Central Line and Lynx. Everybody used to go down to Crackers. And it became, there were people there like Trevor Shakes, who was one of the top dancers, and Leon Herbert, who became a big actor and dancer. And he's actually doing a documentary on dancing of that period, and we just followed them, and we became a whole posse, and we went to Bird's Nest, Waterloo, and Paddington, and West Hampstead, and Charlie Brown's, and which was in Turnpike Lane, because they didn't really allow a lot of the black guys who were in posses to go into central London. If you were older, there was clubs like Columbo's and Mr. B's. Q Club, which is more, in actual fact, Q Club, later on in my life, when we started to gig, we did gigs in Q Club. Like I saw Eddie Grant, you know, congratulated me and said, you know, you managed to hold the audience. This is before Imagination again. So, and all of what I've just talked about was pre-Imagination. So it was, as far as I could remember, there's always been a musical thing about me. And what it was, everybody used to say, and even yesterday I spoke to Leon Herb, and he said every time he thinks of when he sees me, I was always singing and screaming at the top of my voice, or the echo in the underground. You know, and it was just trying to prove yourself, trying to be, you know, I thought, I'm not as good as that person. I'm going to try and be as good as that and refine it. And will I get there? You know.
So how did that talk come around? How did that actual start with when you went into EMI and you did an impromptu?
That was way before. That was way before. That was years before. I mean, when I went into EMI, I became a duo while I was still at school. And that was really, I think, the start of my career in, say, recording. It was mid-70s. And a good friend of mine, Russell Fraser, who's not with us now, well, he's passed, you know, God bless him. He's very fondly missed. And he was very much into Motown, the Jackson 5, Diana Ross and everything. So we're doing all our Dancing Machine, and we started to do routines and stuff and started writing. So he wanted everything fast. He wanted everything fast and quick. But we were very determined, because we ended up in some places. When I think back, how did we get there? I remember we went down to, we had a list of all these different studios. And we went to Eddie Grant's studio in Osbaldeston Road in Soap Newington, and he gave us advice. And at that time, there was four of us in the group. There was four of us, but the others were not really serious. And then we went down to Eddie Grant's record company in Tin Pan Alley, and we saw all these studio, all these people, and, you know, found names and other. And then I remember we found ourselves at Island Records when it was just starting out in Hammersmith, to the point where they were still building things. And we just wanted to do, we had all our songs, not with any music, just a cappella with the songs. And they said, look, you've got something going, but you know, the normal thing, come back. And then we still determined again. So we went to EMI and we were in the reception and we looked up and I thought, God, this is the picture where the Beatles were, you know? And so we went into the reception and no lie, it was like something out of an MGM film. We go into the reception, sitting there, and this guy is there watching us. He's got his glasses on, he's got all this thing. And I'm saying, I bet he's a manager. You know, it's that must speak to him. So yeah, so we just went straight and said like, do you manage? He says, yes, I manage a group, da, 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 da. He turned out to be, his name was Roy Fisher, and he managed the Spiders of Mars, which is David Bowie's backing band. And they had just got this big deal with EMI, and he has his record label, which is going to be connected to EMI. He said to us, well, what do you do? So right in the reception in front of everybody, we just sang and danced in front of everybody, our songs we made up. You know, so everybody was like clapping and stuff like that. And he was like, okay, you know, I like you guys, you know, really come to my to my office in Wimpole Street. So we went to his office in Wimpole Street and he said, like, I'd like to do a deal with you, but you're underage, so your parents have to sign. So they went to my mom and Russell's mom and dad and stuff, and we signed and stuff like that. Went in the studio. We wrote one song called One Life to Live, and the other song was written by Dennis Bond. It was called Get Up, Part One, Part Two, which was... But the funny thing about it was my memories were, we went down, it was in South Moulton Street, Mayfair Studios on the left-hand side. There was a place called, was it Rockies or something? And when I used to eat meat, they had these big hamburgers and Knickerbocker Glories, and we were going to the studio to sing and we're eating all this food. And then we went to the, because Russell was like, oh my God, how am I going to sing these notes? Went to the studio. I know, exactly. And there were live musicians there. We had Thunder Thighs, the backing singers, and they sang on Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. And we had Phil Chang, who I think he played for Rod Stewart. And Del Newman produced it. Del Newman was a big producer and arranger for Diana Ross, Paul McCartney, loads and loads of people. But we didn't know how big they were at the time. Afterwards, I had to do all my research, but I remembered all the names. That was one thing. I always used to look on every album cover to see who did what. So I'd always pick up on the name. Russell wasn't always so much into that, but I was always into that. And anyhow, I think we recorded the record. The record company tried to put it out or something happened and they changed names and it became word of mouth. And then they went us back in the studio and it became a shambles. Nothing happened. I thought I say to people, I think we got to number two in Finsbury Park. but it was a wonderful experience. I didn't find it negative because from it, I was learning how to record my voice in the studio. Do harmonies. I got my own tape machine and stuff like that. So I started to experiment a lot at home. You know, I had a TIAC thing. And I was trying to learn my craft. And that to me was so important. Russell was more into how much we're going to get, you know, do this and the other. And we found ourselves in so many wonderful experiences, watching so many people. You know, we got to do interviews when we were that summer at West Indian World, and we interviewed the Brothers Johnson, of all people. We managed to sneak into the Inn on the Park Hotel and interview Diana Ross in the lift, coming down in the lift. we got to see Doris Troy, and then she asked us to come on stage with her to dance. Doris at the Rainbow Theatre with Madeline Bell, so who's now a good friend. There's so many little stories that led up before Imagination. So by the time I did Got to Be Good, the track with Trevor Horn, I had these wonderful learning experiences, all diverse, all different, all very colourful. I even forgot, and I said to somebody, after Marcel King left Sweet Sensation, I was offered the job to be the lead singer of Sweet Sensation, you know, but I turned it down because I'd seen them at the Lyceum, and I thought, oh, great, and I thought, I don't want to replace, you know, and I was very much I'd studied the industry by then, and I knew a little bit about.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With groups, where they were going, where they weren't going. I mean, I ended up doing a lot of sessions with an American session musician. So we worked with the Velvettes and Delphonics and Chairman of the Board, the third or fourth member, or who formed their own version of it. So I was always the main backing vocals for each of these groups, and we go to all the army bases, and it was great. It was fantastic. So it gave me a lot of experience, and also, you actually know what you want to do next. So the next step going into the frying pan was when I went to R&B and took Got to Be Good. And they took the master tape of the track, sent it to America, and lost it. It got lost. This is supposed to be my first record coming out, got lost. And this is all the big hoopla, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. So I didn't trust them. So they thought, oh my God, you know, we've got this artist here, and you know, what are we going to do? So the next thing, was I met Tony Swain, because Ellis Elias, one of the directors, had said, I've got a tape and I think this, you could write something. I like your writing. This could be something you could write on. So I thought, okay. Now, another reason why I didn't really trust the record company was spinning back 2 years before. I was in Wardour Street, and I went to a company there with some of my demos, and they liked me then. I met Manny, the brother of Ellis, and he wanted me to sing a track which they gave to Kelly Marie, who became a number one hit. But the track they played was something Stranger or something or the other, and Paradise or something like that. I remember it really well. And Manny doesn't even remember, but he met me then. But I wasn't too sure, because they had Jesse Green, who did Nice and Slow, and that was a hit. But I didn't see a lot of artists like myself. I wasn't too sure. And anyway, I went off doing something else and forgot. I think I became a singing waiter, to be honest with you. And then I forgot about that. I give it a break. But then what happened was, going forward, I got the cassette that Ellis Elias had given me with the music that Tony Swain had put on it, and I listened to it, and I thought, this is interesting. And I started to write some lyrics and a melody, and I used one of my cassette machines and another machine and started overdubbing my voice and stuff. And I said to Morgan, I want to come into the studio. I've got a song. And he said, which one? I said, the song that Tony's given me. So I said, okay, you know, you've got the time. I said, well, I'm going to bring a friend of mine in it with me because, you know, so you guys have messed me up already once and I'm not going to mess about, you know. So I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to form a group. So therefore, if the group flops, it's not going to screw up my solo career. And that's how imagination really started. And so therefore I called Ashley in and we, because I was into Ashford and Simpson so heavily, I said, let's try and do like an Ashford and Simpson sort of style on this track, which became Body Talk, which is late 80 when I wrote it. And then we recorded it. We rehearsed and rehearsed, rehearsed, rehearsed. We didn't record the vocal straight away in the studio. Tony and Morgan were like, wow, this sounds really, really cool. But I wasn't recording. I was just singing over the track and doing all the backgrounds and ideas and stuff. And they said, look, could you record something? So I thought, all right, yeah, we hadn't signed anything. So that's why I was like thinking, well, we haven't signed a deal yet. Why am I going to record it? You know, I was thinking the business side. Anyway, we recorded it all in one take. We did the two, one take. That was it. Morgan was like saying, that's it. You don't need to do another version. And we just did the backgrounds. And then we had it. And Tony was the same. So they then took that and put it on an acetate and took it through all the clubs. And they worked and tweaked it and pushed up the bass and stuff and heightened the vocal and everything like that. And people, because it was very hypnotic, it had an element of jazz, it had an element of funk. There was even an aesthetic of reggae in the feel, in a sense as well, in the bass and the heaviness. And a class with the sense and the difference of vocal tones and everything. It embraced the DJs because we're just coming out of disco. There was a funk thing coming up, but it was not wasn't 120, 130 BPM now. It was coming down to 115, 110, 109, those kind of tracks, but they still had a beat, a groove to it. So we were coming right back to that kind of funk feel that they had in the early 70s, but now in the 80s. And, you know, and then it all started. Basically, we started to do all the clubs, went out to all the different clubs. And then midway, they were asking me, well, what do you want to do? Are you going to be a solo artist or a group? So I said, all right, well, let's try and do something like Police in the look. So I'd auditioned with another band called Midnight Express, and Errol Kennedy was the drummer. So I liked how he played because he listened to how I was singing, how I was moving. Because with me, when I'm on stage, it's very important that the drummer is aware of my body movements. Because if I'm dancing, if I'm doing a certain thing, whatever, it's all interlinked. So the bass, the drums, the keyboard, everybody's looking at, because I'm doing certain accents and stuff like that. So it's so important. And movements, you know, the body has a lot, you know, can express a lot when you're talking music. You have to really be into it. And a lot of people don't realize this. So he was really good at that. Understand, it's a jazz thing as well, because I love jazz. So we got him on board. Body Talk was going through all the different clubs everywhere. Number one, every R&B chart, soul chart, and decided to do interviews and everything like that. And walking down Tottenham High Road one day, somebody from the house I was sharing, because I'd left home by this time, because I thought, well, it's time to be the musician and be on your own, said, you've got a phone call at home. The record company's trying to get hold of you. Where are you? Where are you? This is pre-mobile. So I phoned them and they said, we're number 44 in the chart. I said, oh, fantastic. Oh, great. Oh, and I just thought, well, that would be it. Because at those times, it didn't push Black British music at all. They would come in and come out and that was it. Two records, boom. And so I thought, okay, cool. That's good. And then next day I got a call saying, you may be on Top of the Pops because the group has fallen out. So I think, you know, be prepared. So, I thought, okay, I thought nothing of it. I thought, then I got another phone call saying, Lee, where are you? You're supposed to be here at the company so as to discuss what we're going to do for Top of the Pop. I said, you said you may be on Top of the Pop. You didn't say we were on it. He said, yes, you are on it. So everything went crazy. Cabs, organizing what we're going to look like, the whole concept, you know, this Arabic sort of you know, ethereal sort of look with a theatrical sensibility, but still being kind of show business. But and then Morgan was very crucial to saying, you've got 3 minutes on TV, you've really got to push it. You've got to let people remember you. You can't be the Four Tops or, you know, those groups that just stand and do nothing. People have to be talking about you the next day. So on my shoulders, I had all this weight. And at the same time, I'm on the show that as a kid, as families, we'd all be watching. We'd be sitting in front of TV watching it, dreaming that we'd be on this show because it was the mainstay of British TV on a Thursday night or Wednesday night. Well, yeah, Thursday night. Yeah. And the rehearsals, and that I think what you said previously about when you work and work and work and work and work in it, and you're rehearsing life. And the moment where we went over the Pops had been part of that whole rehearsal. So by the time I actually got to perform that, I was very prepared. I knew I had to be in a certain frame of mind, a certain discipline, because we had to repeat things over and over and over for the cameras, for this, for that, you know, and I had to be reduplicating everything. So, you know, I had to be really professional and tight in what I was doing each time. And as I said, there's a lot of discipline. And then finally, the final filming session was in the evening. And that was like remarkable. It was, is that my cat? Oh, my cat's trying to get in. Hold on 1 second. Yep. Hold on 1 second. Skippy? Yeah, it is you. Come on. Come on. Come on. He had a cystitis.
Oh no.
Yes, didn't you? Yes, didn't you? So he's got a little, you can see here.
All right. It should be Gold Lame, really.
I know. That was in the '80s.
To the story.
That was in the '80s.
I mean, one of the most remarkable things is that, and what you're saying is that that moment, because it was so exciting in lots of different ways, from this visual, you know, amazing look which you all had, to the music, and to also, you know, the type of song it was so original. It just felt so original at that time, and I think it was that combination was what exploded you in terms of that moment of success. How did that moment of success change your life, and was it everything that everyone dreams of? Because a lot of artists go, you know, when I'm famous, my life's going to be okay. Was it that, or is it more complicated?
It's a bit of both, because, you know, we still, you know, like, and someone was telling me about this the other day. They were saying, okay, you know, we were broke, we didn't have any money, da 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 da. And I, at this point in time, I was surviving because, you know, I literally was in 3 or 4 bands. So even though I did Top of the Pop, I always had this realistic thing that how am I going to maintain? How am I going to keep myself together? To the point where even though we'd done it, because, you know, the next day and everything, you know, I was thinking, well, I may have to go back and sign on the dole, you know, because I hadn't signed on the dole throughout my period of grafting. Only 6 months prior to that, a friend of mine said, why don't you sign on the dole? You can get some money. And I thought, oh, really? You know, I said, because you're not earning. And the record company said, no, so we need to put you on a wage or whatever like that, so you can, you know, can keep things going. But the life changed. It changed to a level where from 1981 till 1989, I'd even say, it was work nonstop. It was work. It was real. It was like, it was all about the work. It was work. And writing and creating. And at that point in time, if you were in the newspapers, you sold records. So, you know, they'd put ridiculous things in the newspapers and stuff. And that was basically to sell records. And even if you didn't want to do it, you'd have a press person or somebody who'd make something up or whatever to sell records. I mean, now it doesn't make any difference, but that was what was part of the game. And also, we became pillars in the community, because there was all of a sudden, everybody thought we were American to start with. Then gradually throughout, as the year was ending, we had our third hit single, Flashback. everyone's thinking they're from the UK. And then that's when the press starts saying, oh, you know, they're very camp, they're very this, they're the other. You know, the media, they want to try and pull you down. While if they see Funkadelic or Parliament or even Earth, Wind & Fire, they're not going to say the same situation. While we then started to do shows with Earth, Wind & Fire and Kulina Gang, who are, you know, saying, bigging us up and saying, wow, you know, like, you guys are really hot. We love what you do, blah, 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 blah. And they were from America. While in the UK, the media, not the audience, which is a different situation. The media starts to write, and they do that with everyone. They do that with every, you're you know, having it for a while. It's an English situation. They want to put you down, but then they still want to own you if you're doing well elsewhere. Yeah. And I didn't really dance the tune of what they wanted me to do. I was always rebelling. I was always, you know, with the record company, I was rebelling. I just thought we didn't have enough budget. You know, and we didn't have the budget that we should have had for certain things. And it was a fight, you know, and I would say, why are you guys so cheap? And they hated me saying that. You're so cheap. We should be getting, you know, we've done this, we've done that, we've done it, you know, because they'll build you up in one sense, but then they're trying to pull you down in another. So it was a lot of life lessons, but I didn't leave the situation with bitterness. I came in with what I left in, which was the talent God gave me, and also be able to still continue doing what I wanted to do, which some people unfortunately didn't. I didn't get into the drug scene. I wasn't into that kind of situation. We'd go out and get pissed and get drunk at the Limelight later on in, you know, the clubs, but we were not, I didn't come from that body of people who, you know, they always had my back. We weren't into like, oh, should we get out of it? And, you know, plus in the early 70s, when I was a kid, and I'd seen things like Lady Sings the Blues, I started to read all these biographies of all these different artists, especially, and these are black artists, and how a lot of them had descended. And it stayed in my mind. It stayed in my mind. I said, I don't want to end up like that, you know? And I'd say, if I got pissed or something one night, I'd say, oh my God, I'm having a Billie Holiday moment or something. You know, this is, no, this can't be like that. You know, I got to make sure the next day I'm together, you know? So I always had this little third eye speaking to me, you know, and stuff like that.
Do you think, I mean, I want to just mention Drive again, because I think it sort of fits into everything I want to say here. If I think about my own drive, and I'm a writer today, and I was an MTV presenter, and my drive, I think, came from the fact that, okay, the 70s and 80s were shit. If you were black, if you were gay, if you were a woman, you know, there was misogyny, there was racism, there was homophobia. It was everywhere. You know what I mean? Now, I don't want to compare myself as a white gay man to a black man, because there isn't a comparison. But there is a comparison in one sense, I think. And that is that I felt very outside the society when I was growing up. Because of my sexuality, that I wasn't part of the mainstream. And I didn't have those symbols that you were saying as well. I didn't have that mirror. And if the mirrors that I had were like those old, very camp, queenie comedians that I didn't see myself as, you know,
exactly,
but it's not, you know, what I was, sort of thing, or what I felt I was. And so I think when I started with MTV, MTV said, we need to talk about whether you can be gay. You know, and this is MTV in 1987. Yeah. And the whole of the 80s was a bit shit in that way. And I remember having a black boyfriend, and we could never get a cab if we stood together. So we used to have this technique where he'd hide right around the corner and I'd get a taxi so we could get back. And that's when I thought, shit, you know, I thought it was hard to be gay.
But it wouldn't stop.
A lot harder than that. I mean, and I think, you know, what you had to go through and achieve must have been an immense drive and a responsibility in a way. You feel
totally. I tell you, one of the things I was talking to my mate Leroy Logan, who's portrayed in the Steve McQueen Small Axe series, and Tyrone Huntley portrays me, which is interesting, which is really, I didn't think that anyone, I reached this age where someone's actually portraying me, which was a thrill. But I was talking and said, don't you remember those days when the Black Mariah would be driving down the road and they would stop you and stop and search? Now, I used to be doing those gigs in Brixton, and I'd come on the Victoria Line to Stroud Green Road at Finsbury Park, get out, walk up, and be stopped 7, 8, 9 times, to the point where they knew it was me. I was him again, because he has his little plastic bag. And I remember I had this plastic bag which said PAK Butchers, Pack Butchers. And I had this cassette tape always in it, with all my tapes and my music sheets and everything. And they said, oh, it's him again. All right, get in. And they take me home to the top of the end of my road. But then there were other times when I had to dodge in and out of streets. If you saw them, you hid, and then you moved out. And it was like, it was a fear, because you thought, oh my God, they'll stop me, that, you know, throw me in the wherever. So you had that. Then you had a situation, is like when we were going out to the club scenes, and like my mate Leroy was driving, we'd get stopped, or we'd be watching to make sure police is going past us, but they would just stop us, you know.
Isn't it wider racism that music of that era, and this is what you're doing with Flashback the movie, you know, the music of that era wasn't at the time given enough respect and airtime because it was black music.
And that we had to fight.
I can imagine one of the reasons that you want to do this documentary is to say, hang on a minute, this is, you know, like when people, they talk about today, if you're gay, you want to rewrite history. If you're black, you want to write history. No, we want to tell the stories that were real, and they should be told. Do you know what
I mean? I didn't even need the BLM or any other group to rewrite this. I've been working on this for over a decade. So the situation, I started this in 20, whatever it was. And it was initially my co-producer, who's French, wanted to do an imagination documentary. And I was kind of like oohing and ahhing. And I thought, okay, let's try it. But I want to co-produce it and direct it and be part of the whole thing. So we said, yes, whatever you want. So we worked out a deal. And then I started to interview people. And then I stopped and I said, let me get somebody else to do the interviews to start with. So we get a fresh outlook. So we interviewed a few different people, blah, 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 blah. And then I started to listen to, and when I was in the studio, listen to all these different stories. And I thought, this is bigger than imagination. This is more. I said, some of these stories will never, ever be told, or no one will ever get to hear it if we don't widen this whole situation here and let people know where it comes from, where it happens, but also in a positive note, not in a negative note. So then I said, right, let's change the whole thing. I want to do it about black music, British black music. And my co-producer was like, oh, okay, cool. So he thought, oh, we just do a little bit of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And that's what everybody thought. But in my mind, I thought, no, we have to reach back and we have to reach forward. And somebody said to me, a director, a producer said to me, it's going to take you 8, 9 years. And I said, no, you're joking. No, no, no. He said, it will. He said, there's all these different hurdles that you have to get through. And then you're going to stop. And then you're going to start again. And then, and he was right, because trying to get certain interviews with certain artists, they weren't always available. Some people had success and then they didn't have success anymore. So all of a sudden they wanted to do an interview with you.
What were the surprising stories that you were told, things that shocked you? Could you give me one example of something where you just went, oh my God, you know, that's amazing.
It wasn't really that it was shocking, because I've been on the road all my life. So, you know, since a kid. So it wasn't, I couldn't really say that anything was so shocking. There were wonderful stories, you know. I mean, Elaine Del Mar, who's a jazz singer, whose father was working with Snake Hitch Johnson in the 1930s and 40s. You know, he basically survived a bombing. The whole band he was in all died except him. And that was the Café de Paris. So Snake Pit Johnson's died, everybody else died, but he survived it and then formed his own band. She told me some wonderful stories. So those are interesting. Lavi Sifri, who never does interviews, extraordinary musician and person. Eddie Grant, who I interviewed, who I knew as a kid, you know, he told me they made it in Germany first because there was the outlet, you know, when they were in the, when he was in the Eagles with Baby Come Back, before it came, you know, before it actually came out, came became a hit over in the UK, Britain following yet again. You know, it's there were so many stories. Of, I mean, I've interviewed people from sound systems to DJs, pirate radio, people of from the classical field. We've got, that's where, how far I went back to the early days of classical music. Nadine Thompson, I think. Shirley Thompson is a classical conductor, a female black conductor who's done some fantastic arrangements. And she introduced me to a world I didn't even realize existed of classical black composers, which we've now put in the documentary, to the point where, you know, we got into grime and dubstep, which is all the derivative of reggae and of the UK reggae scene of Lovers Rock. But then also we have the Brit funk scene and the club scene. And then, you know, we had the acid scene, you know, the house scene. There's so many, you know, the acid jazz people, you know, I interviewed. I literally went through that period of talking about Normski when he had his show, because it was derived from, they saw MTV and thought, wow, we have to change our look on TV, to interviewing one of the Cleopatras, first black young group to have a cartoony sort of show. So I've had some extremely diverse people, and we're nearly to the point of now finishing it. But it's
interesting because you talk about this, and it's again the expansion of musical horizons, isn't it? I mean, you're going, it's almost like your very young youth in New York. It's again, you're suddenly let's say rediscovering. You've probably known most of it, but you're rediscovering and maybe discovering something new there as well. Has it led you to new musical styles that you want to experiment in yourself?
Because
I know, like, you've done this jazz album, your voice is so beautiful on that album. I mean, it's fantastic.
I'm proud of that album. I'm very, very, I'm more proud of that album than I am of the Imagination albums, because one, I had control. I'm not saying I didn't have control with the Imagination albums. I did, because I was writing all of the songs along with Steve and Tony. But with this album, it was like jumping into the pool. And Stefan Parolo, who is my co-producer of the making of DVD, because he said, Ali, if you want to do this album, you have to do a DVD, a making of, because this is going to be the future. I said, no, what making of? This was like 2004. And he says, yes, check this out. And he sort of showed me, because in France, where I'm very huge, and France has led me to Africa, South America. France is a huge territory. It's much bigger than the UK. And there's a lot of diversity and creativity. And I found that I can do so many different things. So when I come back here, I'm kind of like a snob in the UK, because I'm kind of like, well, you know, I'm like, I've got a song coming out with Classic Bertrand in Belgium soon. I've got a track with Jorge Vasilo from Brazil in end of the year. I've just done the Gorillaz. So I've, you know, but it's because I've done other things that are accessible. And like Damon, he loved some of the stuff I did in France. So, and he knows it, because he is me here. They play me every day. But when I did the jazz album, it was like I was going to jump into the ocean from a high cliff. And what I had to do was go back to that little boy in 1974. Was listening to Lady Sings the Blues and Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan's album, where she sang My Funny Valentine. And then I thought, let me rediscover all of this. How can I do this? So I watched, there's a video, Story of Jazz. It was a box set, and it engulfed everything. And it started with, you know, Bessie Smith and Robert Johnson, and up to the bebop area, to Miles Davis, to Herbie, all the way up to today. And I just listened to it and threw it all away. And they said, right, now what do you want to do? And so therefore, I had a selection of songs that I had, and I basically changed some of them into a jazz mode. Some of them had a bit of a R&B sensibility about it, but I wanted to have that natural feel. So, for example, there's a track called You Never Know and Thin Line, where I was listening to Erykah Badu and her interpretation of stuff. And I said, I like the way she's lyrically saying the story. So I thought, I can do something like that. You know, you get up with an angry head, the same as when you went to bed. Was it, my brain can't think now. But it basically, it's you're telling a story like you're talking to somebody. But I love that idea. It had a different poetic reference. So it gave me a different chance creatively. So I did that. And then even to the point where I always loved Strange Fruit, the Billie Holiday song. But I wanted to do my own version. And one thing that I remember dipping back into my past again and bringing it forward was years ago as a kid on black and white TV, and I knew I'd heard it and seen it, but didn't realize who it was. And I found out, I remember seeing this woman singing it, not Billie Holiday, in black and white TV, and it stunned me. And it was Cleo Lane. And it stayed in my mind. And I just loved just the way she formed her own words and phonetically and stuff. So I just thought, that's what I must do for my own way, my own intonations, my own feel of it. And it went on from there. The tracks like Jazzmatazz, where I harmonized and things like that, it took me back to the bebop era and all that kind of stuff, where I loved all that kind of sound. I got that chance to exhibit different sides of what I could do. And I had lots of success in France and other areas. In the UK, there was a controversy because of the person I was on, a certain person who was on the same label as me. And they don't push black jazz singers in the UK. Someone like myself. And then there were some people, oh, them jazz album. Oh, how dare you? You know, it's like, are you doing an imagination jazz, singing imagination jazz songs and trying to box me? And I'm thinking, no, you know, I'm kicking it out there. And it was very hard because there were some agents that thought, well, you know, I'll book you as imagination, but I'm not sure I'm going to book you as jazz. Then I had other people who said, well, I'm going to take you on. You know, I love what you're doing. Come on. And I developed a completely new audience who now weren't probably into imagination, but they're now into me doing the jazz. So now when I do my shows, I get both because I can merge the two. But it was a fight and a battle. And it's a situation of why can't I be diverse and do different things? And then this is the same situation when I was interviewing different artists, the same thing they went through. And some of them had to go into acting, had to do... you know, for example, Nadia Katush, I don't know if you know who she is, mm-hmm. But Nadia Katush was like a folk singer in the 60s, and she came around the same time as Cleo Lane, and she was singing at that time, and I knew the name, my mother knew the name, and Magnum Bell knew who she was, but it turned out she was the mother of Mike Lindup from Level 42. The only black member in the group, you know. So it was interesting to hear her journey, but I couldn't put all of that in the film. The problem we have in Flashback, there's so much stuff that you can only talk of a genre and pick one person from that genre and then move on. Otherwise, you're there for 18 hours. So, you know, so in doing that and then also having the experience of filming myself for the jazz album, it gave me, all of a sudden I became a film director, and then I went on to do I did three documentaries for SOS Children, one in Zambia, one in Tunisia, one in South Africa.
You also released a book, didn't you?
I did. Have I got it? Yeah, I did.
I've ordered it. It hasn't come yet. From Within the Heart.
Within the Heart. Thank you. All the money goes to the charity. All the money goes to charity. You know, let me know, email me.
What does it give you doing something for charity? Do you know what I mean? Because there's always, mm-hmm. I don't mean you don't do that to get something, but mm-hmm. whenever you do something which is, you know, of value to other people, mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. something, you get a sort of payback, don't you? So I just wonder what...
Well, what you could... You know, the world is funny how we are born. And the first thing I thought, I could be in that person's place. It could be me there. Could you imagine? It could be me there suffering, having that suffering. So why wouldn't I? That's the first thing I think. And the second thing is I always think I've been blessed and gifted that I can travel, and through the music it's brought me to help these people. So it's, and it's easy for me to do. It's not a problem to do it. So I think if I get the opportunity and the chance, I jump on it. So when I'm doing certain shows, for example, we went to Brazil a few years back and I managed to go to SOS there and heightened the fact that I am an ambassador for SOS. So therefore that raised money. We went to Mozambique in February last year, just before lockdown. The same thing. The promoter didn't realize how strong I was with SOS. And so what happened was the press and the TV all followed me to this village with the kids. And I said, right, okay, you're doing all this, let's raise some money, you know, because, it makes your heart, it's good for your heart to do something like this. But I do it because of my feeling and my, you know, and that I've been lucky and blessed that I can do it. And so when I get the chance, if I can, I can, you know, and that's it. It's and filming it gave me seeing the environments that these kids were in, especially in Zambia when we went, we did the whole thing. It's online. I don't know if you've seen it, the SOS Children in Zambia, it's on YouTube. And you can see the journey we went. I took my band on this funny bus that we were on. And you see other people, how they grew up in their different environments. And it touches my spirit. The house mothers that look after all these kids and everybody that volunteers their time and energy, their strengths and their faith, how they devoted they are to doing it. And that inspires me. That gives me an injection. It's like, wow, they really, you know, do it. It separates you from this world that we're in, because there's so much frivolity, there's reality television and people who are, you know, they're in some needy, you know, me. And then you see that, which is a complete different side of it. And it brings you back to a sense of reality. And I'm just a person that's doing my thing. I get on the train and I'm, you know, like I was saying to Archie the other day, my manager, I was saying, right, we're on a new train now. The old train's left at the station because, you know, that was pre-COVID. Now we're on a new train. And we just have to keep being as positive and uplifting as we can, even though it's really hard. And my career hasn't just been ups and downs of, ooh, and music and lights. There's been tips. You know, there's been, my manager died in the early 90s, which was very devastating. And other people that were part of my life passed away as well. And it was, you know, there were certain points. So now we're in the COVID period. It reminded me, and I've talked to this to some people, it reminded me, and it's not the same, when the AIDS pandemic first started, because people were comparing the AIDS pandemic to, no, I was comparing the AIDS pandemic to this period, because I was saying, you've got people that were very ignorant about AIDS. Then you've got people that are ignorant about taking the injection. You know, you had people telling people, look, this is what's happening, you need to know. You've got people telling people this is what's happening to know. And it's the combustion, yet they will go out and do that. They will go out and do that here as well in the both periods of time. And you see how the governments are now all worrying, you know, and it's because people don't listen, they don't think ahead of time. And they're not all for the people. It's all about money. They're thinking, okay, we give an injection and we're not getting any money from it, then why are we giving it away for free? You know, things like that. So all of a sudden you become, even if you didn't want to become politically aware, you are part of the politics, so to speak. And
I think that was, you know, my point about the 80s and the 70s, that particularly if you were in some form of minority, you had to become political because you had no choice.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, part, yeah, of being in your blood. What I want to end with, which you said, I presume you live somewhere around Turnpike Lane. You were mentioning Turnpike Lane. Do you still live around?
Oh, no, you lived there before? I lived in North London. I lived in Finsbury Park. And then we lived in Hornsey. And then when I thought, right, Body Talk's breaking, I'm going to be a big star. Wow, you know, I'm going to live on my own. And my mom said, let me live on your own. I said, yeah, I need to. So a friend of mine said, oh, we've got a room in the house. Some school friends who bought a house, and another friend was a designer. He actually designed some of the imagination stuff. And he said, oh, you know, Abby, a friend of ours, got a room, you know, come there. So that was in near the Tottenham football grounds.
Right.
And so I lived there for a while, and then I ended up living in Hendon, which was completely different, you know. So, but North London has always been, I say, my base in a sense, though I'm in Northwest London now.
Yeah, when I moved to London, I moved to Dongola Road, which is off West Green Lane.
West Green Road.
Yeah. And so I know that area quite well.
There used to be the West Green Road Community Centre around there. Yeah. But my mom. Oh, you said when you mentioned Turnpike Lane, my mom's community centre, the Afro Caribbean Centre, is near Turnpike Lane. It's right near there, and right now it's in disrepair. They're hoping raising money to the council's supposed to fix it up, because it's a hub for the community. You know, it's been there for so long, but there's a lot of politics with the stuff going on. And as you rightly said, when we were and actually, when I was speaking to Leon yesterday, my friend Leon, who's doing his thing about the dancing, it was a fight. It was always a fight. Even when we were doing TV, promoting, we made it look like it was fun, it was love, we're having a great time. But I was watching live at the Dominion. You can go on YouTube. It's going to be there for a while, but it's going to go. And our first live tour, we sold out 7 nights, and actually, we got an award. It's over there. 7 nights, 8 shows at the Dominion Theatre in London. No British black band had done anything like that. None. Even today, I don't see anyone like that. You know, but no one knew. No one made anything about it. It was like, oh, okay. But it was a big deal, and we did it twice. And I was watching the performance, because a keyboard player the other day was saying he hadn't seen it. I said, oh, go online, da, da, da. So I said, you know what? I'm going to watch this, because we're doing a 40th anniversary album, which is coming out next year. It's going to be like 14 albums, 3 or 4 of them with unreleased stuff, some live stuff, some rule. It's going to be really, really cool. And some shows that we're going to put in. And so I was listening to all these different tracks and stuff I hadn't listened to for years. So as I was doing this, I just clicked on to YouTube to watch this Dominion Theatre and watched myself. And then I was surprised at myself, seeing myself there. I thought, oh my God, wow. And I was speaking to Mel Gaynor from Simple Minds, who's been drumming for us for a long time. And he said to me, you know, I loved it. I loved that show, Neil. And I said to him, I was so serious. I was very serious. I had to get it right. Even I'm singing sexy songs, and I was all the way through. I'm serious. I'm laughing at a few little bits and pieces, but because I knew the camera was there and everything, I had to be serious. I had to be strong. I had to be tough. I had to be on it. And then I watched another episode, which is completely different. Maybe a year later, we're in Los Angeles, and we're on the program called Soul Train, which is presented by Don Cornelius, and Marvin Gaye was on the same show. And basically, Don Cornelius says something like, this is the group that Marvin Gaye gives his stamp of approval. And I thought, wow. And then when I watched my performance, we did Changes and we did Just an Illusion. And when I'm watching my performance, my shoulders are out here, and I'm like, on your march, get set, go, bam. There again, that face is serious, strong. And by the time we finished the routine, I'm like out of breath. But it's so serious and it's so strong. I thought, you know, that's probably how I look back at myself. I think, you know, you had a lot on your shoulders. You had to really maintain. So you could, even though it looked like we're joking and having fun, we were, and having fun and laughing and stuff, it was serious. It was very, it was always like, it was work. It was like, get it right, make sure you're on point. And that's what I see in the Dominion. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I just finally like to say, because I think what's really fascinating is that you had sort of one massive career that opened into so many. Mm. And it opened up so many avenues in your life. And I think that's really fascinating. You're not someone who's like, looking back at a high point and that was it. You're someone who's had the high point and it's carried on in different ways.
Oh,
because the most important thing as a human is to keep developing and creating, and that's what you've done. And
it
I really appreciate
it. It is. I mean, thank you. I mean, I've had some really good high points, and you know, I still get excited. You know, the Gorillaz, you know, was a number one on iTunes, the track I did, The Lost Chord. In every decade, I've always had something. You know, I had number two in the 90s with The Mighty Power of Love. That was with Mood to Swing, which I've introduced. We had a number one with Instinctual, which introduced David Morales. I did something with, and what's the name again, DJ Fantasy, which was Mind, Body and Soul, big UK garage record. Then they're always something. The DJs always love me. They always want me to do something. So it's fun, and it re-innovates. So I think in doing that, so it's fun to do it as long as you enjoy it. And as long as there's a little bit of melody going on with the beats, then I'm happy, you know, so, and harmony.
And that's it for this full-length interview with Lee John. I'll see you next Thursday for Throwback Thursdays and every Monday for a new podcast interview.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad,
a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news.
We're watching.
Fashion trends. Pep talks where we give advice.
Mental health moments.
And games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Well, well, well. Shopping for a car?
Yep. Carvana made financing a car as smooth as can be.
Oh, yeah?
I got pre-qualified instantly and had real terms personalized just for me.
Doesn't get much smoother than that.
Well, I got to browse thousands of car options on Carvana, all within my budget.
Doesn't get much smoother than that.
It does. I actually wanted a car that seemed out of my range, but I was able to add a cosigner and found my dream car.
It doesn't get much...
Oh, it gets smoother. It's getting delivered tomorrow.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to get pre-qualified today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.